Alan Kring Productions in association with the Emergent Light Studio presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Financial Management, MBA 440 for Spring Semester 2022. Tonight, Free Cash Flow Estimation. The purpose of this lecture and this topic is to actually project your needs for capital. How much of a hole are you going to be in when you look at your free cash flows next year or the year after that? Or are you going to have surplus? This number, this available amount of money, gives you the ability to plan ahead. If you have positive free cash flow, that can obviously be provided, used in part as dividends, and it can also be used for some of the funding of a project. Important to remember in this regard is that a company doesn't, let me draw this, and I showed this to you before, and I'm going to remind you of it now. Remember that debt plus equity equals total assets. The combination of debt and equity as percentages is called the capital structure of the corporation. It's called the capital structure of the corporation. So in other words, if I mark this axis as percent debt, then, and you would have 100% debt, that would be the same thing as saying 0% equity. Now, I'm saying this specifically because on your final exam, I'm going to throw an easy question at you that you may get wrong if you're not paying attention. I might show you this where we're plotting the weighted average cost of capital against the percent of debt, and I'll say, what is the percent of equity at some, or what's the weighted average cost of capital at 40% equity? Well, that would mean that you'd have to look for 60% debt because I was showing you the debt instead of the equity. Okay? So, a long time ago, there was a rather obviously incorrect proposition made by a couple of finance jockeys. Debt is cheaper than equity. Debt is cheaper than equity. One reason is because your interest on debt is tax deductible. The dividends on stock is not. And the other reason is that the debt of a corporation is safer for the investors than the equity. Because the debt investors, if they are not paid, they can shut the corporation off. They'll just end it right there. Earlier this year, I think it was this year, there was a panic about some of the older restaurant chains and fast food chains have been in financial trouble. One that was started here in Bloomington, Steak and Shake, was projected that they would not be able to make a coupon payment on one of their debt instruments, a coupon payment that was coming due, and I think it was like in February. And if they had not made it, that would have been the end of Steak and Shake. And, of course, you know, they don't pay a dividend, they're struggling, but the shareholders can do nothing but cry and go to the shareholders meeting and stomp their feet. They can't do anything about not getting a dividend. They can't do anything really about the stock price going down. They can try a shareholder's derivative lawsuit, but that's very speculative. But if the Steak and Shake had not made that coupon payment, click, that's the end of it, right there. It's ended. So that gives you an idea of just how serious this is. Interestingly, and we're still kind of wondering how they did it, they managed to make the payment. And it was just like, where did you get that money? Did you sell your burgers somewhere in the black market? They managed to make it. So, but do understand that debt is cheaper than equity simply because the debt holders are covered. The shareholders are just all at risk. So debt is cheaper than equity. So if you were talking about the capital structure line of a corporation, if a corporation has 0% debt and all equity, then the weighted average cost of capital would be the cost of equity. Remember, because weighted average cost of capital is the weight of debt times the after-tax cost of debt plus the weight of equity times the cost of equity. So if the weight of debt is zero, then the weighted average cost of capital is merely the cost of the equity. If a company is 100% debt, then it would just be the coupon rate or the yield to maturity on the debt, which should be cheaper. So a company's weighted average cost of capital should look like a straight line going down. That was the Modigliani-Miller proposition. All companies should be 100% debt because debt is cheaper than equity. Why would you ever take a more expensive source of capital if there is a cheaper source of capital? So we should never see a corporation that has any stock outstanding. Of course, that's complete nonsense. We see it all the time. The answer was this. As a company takes on more debt, it must eventually start to pay a higher coupon rate because it's getting riskier. I mean, if a company, you're going to pay more interest. What happens if you have to pay so much interest, like Steak and Shake did, that it is essentially risking default? So at some point, as a company gathers debt, the debt begins to get more expensive than the equity does. In real practical terms, in my company, for example, my credit line each year starts, if I can borrow up to $5,000 at 8.99%. Between $5,001 and I think it's $15,000, I pay a 12.99%. Anything above $15,001, I pay a 20%. So you can see that as I gather more debt, I become riskier, so my cost of debt begins to turn upward. And so the weighted average cost of capital begins to turn upward. So in real life, you'll see a capital structure curve that looks like this. At 100% debt, that debt is going to be really expensive. It's going to be more expensive than equity is. This leads to something right here. This is called the optimal capital structure. It is a combination of debt and equity that minimizes the weighted average cost of capital. The optimal capital structure is the combination of debt and equity that minimizes the weighted average cost of capital. Now, that could be 20% debt, 80% equity. It could be vice versa. Here's the interesting thing. The studies that have been done of capital structure of corporations, we see they're generally about the same within an industry. You'll see some where the percent of debt that is optimal is very low. You'll see others where it's about an equal balance, 50-50. And then you'll see others that are very much, the optimal is a lot of debt in the capital structure. Now, what does this mean? Companies bust their butts to find that optimal capital structure and to stay there. Because that's the lowest weighted average cost of capital. There is a whole science to finding it, and I don't want to go into it in a class like this. Matter of fact, it's almost a PhD level thing. But if you, and it's very characteristic. For example, oddly enough, that one there where the optimal is very low debt, interestingly, we see that more in smaller enterprises. Mom-and-pop restaurants, smaller grocery store chains. The heavier debt tends to be more toward the industrial companies. They have a higher level of debt that is optimal for them. But know this, once you have that optimal capital structure, you have to manage it, you have to maintain it. Think about it this way. If a company has a certain equity debt, let's say that their debt equity structure is 25% debt, this is their optimal, and their equity is 75% debt, okay? They want to stay there. They won't stay there just sitting and watching. Suppose they're a very profitable company. That means that every year, they are going to be gathering retained earnings, equity, and they're going to be paying off their debts. So in a profitable company, it is going to naturally tend for the equity to drift upward and the debt to drift downward. That's just what it'll do. In other companies where they are desperately trying to survive, they will tend to borrow money as fast as they can. Netflix was an example. They were willing to issue junk bonds. And so in a case like that, the debt would go up above the optimal, while the equity necessarily, as a percentage of 100, would go down. So it's not going to just sit there on its own. You have to manage it. Now, what this means is that whenever a company takes on a new project, suppose a project costs $100. Well, they've got $100 in retained earnings. They can do that. Just pay it with what they've got in their bank accounts. But they should not do that, because if they did that, that would automatically throw their weighted their optimal capital structure away. So whenever a company finances its operations, it will finance them according to the optimal capital structure. They will use that combination of debt and equity to finance everything. So what does this mean when we get to free cash flow analysis? When we are looking forward into the future of a company is going to have years when it's got a negative free cash flow. Well, it's obviously going to have to finance that. It has to pay. Those are bills. That's not profit. That's real money that has to be there. In a case like a Tesla, if it's $3 billion in the hole in free cash flow, they have to find that money somewhere. So if they want to find that money, they have to decide. They have to know what their optimal capital structure is. So if Tesla needs $3 billion and its capital structure, optimal capital structure is this, it would have to issue 75% of $3 billion in equity, and they would have to borrow 25% of that $3 billion in debt. That's how they would have to do it. That's how companies do it all the time. In a larger enterprise, they will never finance any project with all debt or all retained earnings. They will divide it up according to the company's capital structure and finance the components of the finance the project according to that. Otherwise, their whole capital structure is off. That's why it's important for us to know free cash flow. Here's the thing. If we have a positive free cash flow, well, that's wonderful. But we probably would want, at least one thing we would do is issue a dividend, okay? So we need to know what kind of a dividend we can issue that will not throw our capital structure off its optimal. The same is true if a company is, like I said, in the hole. It's obviously going to have to get the money from somewhere. So it's going to have to get the money according to what would be its, what would keep its capital structure optimal. That's the motivation for these projecting a free cash flow out a few years, so that you know, okay, we're going to run into trouble down the road here. We're going to have a negative free cash flow of $500 million. Okay, we are, we're 40%, well, let's do it this way. We're 40% debt, 60% equity, okay? Then what we would have to do is call the investment bankers and say, here's what we need. We're going to have to issue 40% of $500 million in bonds, and we're going to have to issue 60% of that $500 million with new stock or with retained earnings and new stock. That's how they would do it. That's why we do these projections. Now, if you go through, and I will be the first one to stipulate that this gets tedious, and I will keep it a little bit short here, just show you the outline of how it's done. The first thing that we need to do is look at the company's current financial statements, its current financial position. Now, obviously, we're going to have to get down there to free cash flow at some point, but we start with the current statements. Now, you recall earlier in the course that we did ratio analysis. What we're going to do is look at its current state of affairs, all the percentages and all this kind of stuff. And then we're going to say, let's project our revenues for next year. We'll do that. We might be, have good justification, or we might just have pie in the sky. But what we are going to do is we're going to project our revenues. And then every other line in the income statement and the balance sheet is going to be based upon the current ratios. Here's the upshot of it, though, the problem. And I do appreciate this about your textbook and the PowerPoints. You need to, before you go attacking and starting to create pro forma income statements and balance sheets all the way out and all your free cash flows, you need to have a look at where your ratios stand compared to the industry. Your ratios might suck. And you would say, well, we can do things the way we always have and still suck next year and the year after that, or we can say, okay, we are going to get this company under control. We are going to get our ratios in line with the industry. We can look at what happens if we keep our ratios the same, but we are going to make an active company-wide mission of fixing our ratios so that they come into line with the industry ratios. Well, what happens if your ratios look better than the industry's? Don't count on that forever. Your ratios will come into line. We know that. You might have a good year. This year, your ratios look better than the industry. That doesn't mean that you think that's going to last forever. Almost always, a company that is actively managing to get to the industry standard. They're not actively managing to beat the industry standard. They're actively managing to get to the industry standard. It's hard enough to get to the industry standard. It is quite another task of much greater significance to keep exceeding the industry standards. You're best to look at the industry standards and say, let's get there, and use those ratios as your projections. So for example, if your cost of goods sold is, let's say, 30% of revenues, if your gross income is, let's say, 30% of revenues, in other words, your gross margin is 0.30, and you see that the industry's average is 0.25, you say, how do we reduce our wholesale costs? If necessary, you do spy work. You find out how the hell are my competitors getting 25 per, getting a better deal than we are. And on the other hand, if you're getting a sweeter deal, you have to ask yourself, how long are we going to be able to hold that before our competitors see us doing that? Okay, here we go. And like I said, I'm going to take you through the basics of the start of this, but I'm not holding you to this for a homework. Take it at your risk. Now, I'm going actively through, and I'm trying to fix everything in the PowerPoints, and I'm also going to put up the Excel spreadsheet where everything, the numbers are correct in it. But for now, the additional funds needed, we're going to look at an additional funds needed equation. That's what I was talking about down there at the bottom line. How much more do we need to have everything work? And we need to know that well in advance, because you can't call the investment bankers and say, hey, well, coming next year, we're going to need $1 billion. They're going to say, are you out of your minds? Probably the run-up to financing is easily 18 months, more likely 24 months, if you are going to need money in the future. You need to tell the investment bankers well ahead of time that you're going to need it. Okay. Another problem that you're going to face is your financing. How are you going to finance it? What is your policy? What is your optimal capital structure? What are you going to finance with debt? What are you going to finance with equity? And then there's another one, too. You will find that sometimes companies have charters or they have some decision that was made that keeps you from doing what needs to be done. You need to know that well in advance so that you can fix it. Well, we have a contract with this supplier that's going, you know, it's a good supplier, and we've got a 5-year contract with them for our, you know, our wholesale stuff. So, you know, we have to honor that contract. And that contract turns out to be adverse to your company's interests. Then you need to have a conversation about this. Don't just say, oh, okay, well, screw that. You have to see what can be done in those kinds of situations. And again, changing ratios. You need to look at what yours are versus the industry's. Taking it forward here, and I'm going to pretend that the numbers are all correct here. You project your income statements, and you look at your financing surplus or deficit, and you project your balance sheet. All of those are going to start it out. Then from there, you're going to have to go from your operating income. Your operating income, which is the same as saying your EBIT, and you're going to have to take 1 minus the tax rate on that. That is NOPAT, net operating profit after taxes. You've seen me write this over and over again. That's your NOPAT. And then you're going to add back your depreciation expense, because that really didn't happen. You didn't write a check to depreciation. It's in here. It was subtracted here, but that was purely to take account of the tax shield that depreciation expense that doesn't exist actually created in reality. And then you're going to have to take out the real capital expenditures. And you're going to have to take out the change in net operating working capital. This is the wild card, by the way. And your book kind of hints at this. Well, it doesn't hint. I think it says it directly at some point. Your net operating working capital is a real hard thing to deal with. In fact, that is the subject of a 300-level course I'm teaching in the fall, is short-term financial management. It is finally beginning to dawn on companies that this is major, because that thing can go crazy on you. Accounts payable can go up, go down. Accounts receivable can go up, go down. And it just gets to be a wild horse. And you really have to keep control of it. Otherwise, that thing is going to be hard as hell to project. I mean, what do you take for a percentage? What do you take for a percentage for the change in net operating working capital from year to year? Is that going to be like 5% of revenues, 10% of revenues? What number do you use there? You might see it for the current year, but the next year, you look back a year or a couple of years, and you'll see, my God, this thing is all over the place. Sometimes it's positive, sometimes it's negative. What the hell is going on? That comes down to deliberate policy of the company. Let's look at this company. Let's look at our short-term financial management. How do we get this under control so that accounts receivable aren't going up and down and up and down, and accounts payable aren't going up and down and up and down? Remember, as accounts receivable go up, that drains free cash flow. If accounts payable goes up or goes down, if accounts payable goes up, that provides cash. But if accounts payable goes down, that drains cash. So you have to get that under control with strict management policies. No, we're not going to start giving more deals for accounts receivable, you know, to get more customers unless we really talk about it first and its impact on free cash flows. No, we're not going to start paying our debts off faster just to make everyone happy with us, because that's going to be a significant drain on our free cash flows. So you need to get that under control before you want to put a percentage on for projections in the future. Each of these, when you put a percentage on it, you are saying, we are going to hold this number as a percentage of revenues or whatever constant. Taking it down, we get ourselves down to free cash flow. That's that mess right there, free cash flow. And then you're going to divide that by the weighted average cost of capital. And you're just going to carry it forward. Now, here they say to infinity. Don't do that. Take it out a reasonable number of years. What's reasonable? I mean, when you get out to 10 years, those free cash flows, more than 10 years out, are really minimal to the overall intrinsic value, the present value of the free cash flows. You stop somewhere along the line. As I showed you last week, in fact, usually at some place we find a horizon value and just leave it at that. But let me take you down here. You do what-if scenarios under different operating plans. And what would constitute different operating plans? Well, the first one would be your growth of revenues. Well, let's grow our revenues faster. Let's get growth rate up. Remember what happens? Does anyone remember? Let's test you on this. Do any of you remember what happens when the growth rate of a company goes up? Remember that one formula for the cost of equity? It's the dividend one period out divided by the weighted average cost of capital minus the growth rate, and D1 is D0 times 1 plus G. But if you accelerate your growth of the company, then what automatically happens is that this denominator becomes smaller, which makes the entire fraction go up, so you're actually increasing your cost of equity by accelerating the growth of your company. So in other words, it's not just grow, grow, grow. Let's get everything in order and let's just grow to the max, because as you do that, you are going to throw the whole shebang out of whack with your weighted average cost of capital. And you are also very likely going to be shifting your capital structure. If you're getting in more revenue, you're probably going to get a larger amount at the bottom line, which means that ultimately your equity is going to be drifting up and your debt as a percent is going to drift down. So all kinds of fun things happen if you decide, well, we're just going to grow our revenues faster. For one thing, good luck with that. For another thing, it causes all kinds of trouble. Yes, grow the revenues, no doubt about that. But don't think that you can just grow them at some rate like 20% next year and every year after that. Not going to happen. And even if it does, you really are going to regret the results. Now, that last line, determine the amount of financing needed to support the plan. In other words, look at your negative free cash flow. How much is it? If it's positive, well, that's good, but you still have to decide on things like what your dividend is going to be. How much are you going to spit off as a dividend? You know, that dividend actually has an interesting consequence. if you are gathering too much retained earnings, then increasing your dividend isn't really just for your shareholders to be happy with you because they got a nice fat dividend check. Sometimes you'll issue a nice fat dividend simply because otherwise your capital structure gets whacked, gets thrown off. If you keep, well, we're going to keep most of this, of what we made, this profit for our internal, plow back into the company. Well, that's great, except that that's increasing your equity against your debt, and off you go from your optimal capital structure. So, a lot of different impacts are coming in this. Now, if you took a second course in a master's in finance, we would go through this in detail. In an MBA course 440, it's supposed to be a survey course. So we don't go into this in extraordinary detail in a course like this. Although Lord knows I do know one MBA professor who seems to think that you're all in a PhD program. Anyway, that's not my purpose here. Okay, let's look at this. The balance sheet of Hatfield as of 2019 and as of 12/31/2019. Okay, you've got cash of 90, accounts receivable of 1260, inventories of 1440. So your total current assets are going to be $2,790. And you've got fixed assets, which are a bigger piece. So you've got a nice thing of $6,390. Now, if you look at the other side, liabilities and shareholders' equity, you've got some payables sitting there. And you don't have any lines of credit. Now, a line of credit is a short-term obligation. It's what I use. I don't have any long-term debt in my capital structure of my company. It's just essentially you're borrowing money at the beginning of a business cycle. You fill up your showroom or whatever it is. You keep your employees paid, and you're doing that with a line of credit that you have. And then as the selling season begins to kick in, you start paying that line of credit back down. So that by the end of the cycle, a business cycle, you are back at zero, and then you can do it all over again the next year. This is very typical. So on a balance sheet like Hatfield's, seeing a zero line of credit would not be unusual. In some companies, the line of credit, they're still hanging some of it on year over year. But for the most part, that should be about a zero. In other words, your short-term debt should be about a zero. It is going to all be dominated by your accounts payable and any accruals that you've got. Now, what do I mean by accruals before we go on? To remind you of accruals, like, for example, when a dividend is declared, that's when it will show up as a dividend on your financial statement. However, you don't pay it right away. You accrue it, and then you pay it later. The same is true for some of your other kinds of obligations. You accrue them. You don't pay them immediately. So those are what we mean by accruals. Are they a big thing? Shouldn't be. Your accounts payable should be the dominant part of it. Now, your long-term debt in this company is $1,800. So your total liabilities are $3,420. Now your common stock, that would be how much you took in when you sold that stock over a period of time. You sold a bunch of it at $100 a share, 100 times that much stock. You sold more of it at $90 a share, that much times 90. You add those up, and that is your paid-in capital. That's your common stock. Now, the retained earnings is where the game begins. The retained earnings, you take the retained earnings at the beginning, and I'm telling you stuff from your accounting course just to remind you. At the beginning, now you add in your income, your net income. For the year, you subtract out the dividends that you paid, and that will get you your retained earnings at the end of the year. That is not a real amount. It's not a real thing, but it's we usually say, well, we finance from retained earnings. That's like saying we're financing from our company's cash drawer kind of thing. Now, you add up the common stock and your retained earnings, and that's going to be your total equity. You add the liabilities and the equity, and you should get the same number as your total assets. And if you're like me doing accounting, you're going to suffer trying to get those two to be the same number. If any of you remember that, trying to get total liabilities plus equity to equal your total assets, that can be a fun exercise in itself. But I want you to notice something. If I looked at, let's look at your total liabilities. Let's use total liabilities. As a percent of your total assets, 3420 divided by 6390 equals. It's 53.5% debt, quote unquote debt. Now, if we look at the equity, we would take 2970. Divided by your total assets, 6390, and that should be about 47%. Well, 46%. Debt plus equity equals total assets. So this company, we're going to start with the assumption that its optimal capital structure is about 54% debt and 46% equity. Why are we saying that? Because that's where we're seeing it. And we would assume that they are at or near their optimal capital structure if they're managing the financial statements, if they're managing the company properly. That should be about what it should be. It might not be, but we can talk about that at another time. But this is what we are probably going to want to target. If we are at a deficit, a negative number on the free cash flow, we should probably talk about dealing with that by borrowing 50%, 54% of it, and using our retained earnings and issuing new common stock to finance the other 46% of it. That's what we should do, probably. So that takes us to our next round here. We've got some numbers here, So that's going to be fun. So now let's look at the income statement. This is 2019. Sales are $9,001. Operating costs are $8,101. Now we're holding depreciation. Usually on real financial statements, you see depreciation embedded here in SG&A. You have to actually go over and look at the cash flow, the statement of cash flows, to find what the depreciation part of that was. So here, they're being nice to us. There are some corporations that actually do show the depreciation separately, but the standard these days, modern standard, is to not list the depreciation separately, to embed it in the SG&A. It's just the way it is. Okay, EBIT. That is the same as the operating income. There is our first toy right there. But we're going to take away the interest expense, and we've got pre-tax of $396. That's what the quick term is, pre-tax. Now, this number is not correct. And this is why this is going to be a pain in the ass if I go too far, because I'm going to have to fix more stuff as I go down the line. The taxes are 25%. Damn it. If you want, I could change the 99 to another number, to 40% of 396, but that's really asking for trouble doing that. So here we go. So your net income is $396. Minus $99, or $297. Now, a little bit of extra. This company last year paid a dividend of $100, okay? So if I were to look at that as a percentage, I would say that this company, the dividend ratio was 100 of $297. So this company's dividend ratio was 34%. So in other words, it plowed back. What's 100 minus 34? 66, yeah. Yeah, 66. I could have done that myself. Okay, I didn't need your help. Okay, so in other words, it's plowback. It's 66%. God, don't get old. Just put yourself in a home. Anyway, okay, so now, the addition to retained earnings is your net income minus what you paid out as dividends. That's why I wrote that there. Okay, you following through? Now, I understand that some of this is review, but if you're like me, I tried to purge my mind of my accounting as soon as I was finished with it. So in other words, your retained earnings, you're adding 297 minus 100. So that boosted you up a nice little amount. Now, you have 50 shares outstanding, so your earnings per share is going to be the $297 divided by 50, or $5.94 per share. So each share of stock has claimed to $5.94. Of that, $2 was given to them as a dividend. Because you gave out $100 to 50 shares, that's $200. That's $2 per share. Right? Yeah. So in other words, your dividend, there it is. Okay. So we're going to say, let's say this ending stock price is $41. Now this is going to be an important thing. Take your earnings per share. Your price, $41, divided by your earnings per share, $5.94. Your price-earnings ratio, is that right? Yeah. Price per share divided by earnings per share. Their price-earnings ratio is 6.9. Here's one of the places where you would look to your industry standard. What is the industry standard P.E. ratio? That's going to be a guideline for you for the future. Because if you hold your earnings constant, you could take the industry average. Or if your earnings grow. Let's say that your earnings next year were $350 on those 50 shares. Well, that would be a price-earnings ratio of, earnings per share. You would take 350 divided by 50. So in this case, you've got a $7 EPS. And you can use that for a new projection of your price of your stock next year. It's something you can do. It's just one of those things. So suppose that the industry standard is your price earnings ratio next year. Okay? So I know that the industry standard PE ratio is 8.5. Okay? Now I've got a 7. So how could that become an 8.5? That would mean that if my earnings are going up, I should see my stock price increase. That's one of the quick, dirty ways you can project where your stock price is going to be next year, because you're going to figure that it will begin to try to track the industry price earnings ratio. It's a quick, dirty thing to do. It's not, well, yeah, it is kind of standard because it's easy. Let's take it down here. Now we begin to look at our cost, the ratios. Okay, operating costs as opposed to sales, rather against sales, we have 90%. The industry standard is 88%. So in other words, right off the bat, we're saying that Hatfield has too many operating costs for the level of sales. So are we going to use 90% to project if we have sales for next year? Are we going to say 90% times our sales next year? Or are we going to use 88% to get our operating costs? In other words, our operating costs divided by sales are 90% right now. So if we know our sales next year, we could times those by 90% and project our operating costs. But do we want to do that, or do we want to say we're going to bring them down to the industry 88% and take 88% of our projected sales next year? That's the first. This is where we're getting into our active management. The depreciation against fixed assets we have is 10%. The industry standard is 12% depreciation against fixed assets. So what does that mean? And can we fix that? Only to a certain extent could we fix that. You see, because depreciation is sort of like there are rules for that. We can't really change that depreciation number at will. The only thing we could do in order to get to the industry standard would be for us to lower the fixed assets against the depreciation. How would we do that? How would you get a depreciation to fixed asset to move from 10% to 12%? That one's on you. You got any ideas about how you could pull that off? There's one easy, dirty trick way to do it. Don't buy any more fixed assets, because then your fixed assets will naturally fall, the net fixed assets, against the depreciation. That's the normal way to do it. Otherwise, yeah, I guess I could sell a factory, but it would be better for that line right there for you to just naturally let that fall. Just stop buying damn new stuff and just let the depreciation, accumulated depreciation, eat away at your fixed asset base a little bit. You don't want to go crazy with that, but let it eat away so that your depreciation to fixed assets begins to go up. Because your depreciation will stay probably about the same or something like that. But your fixed assets, if they are being depreciated, they'll go down, down, down year to year unless you're adding to them. So that would mean lay off the capital expenditures a little bit. Okay, cash to sales. I mean, companies just are really weird about this. In the real world, you see the cash situation of companies bounce up and down kind of weirdly. But here, they're at the industry standard. Do more of what you're doing now. Don't add cash at some disproportionate rate to sales. Just make sure that your cash is remaining at about 1% of sales. And that'll keep you at the industry average. Here's one, receivables to sales. 14% for Hatfield against the sales, against sales, but the industry is 11%. So what does that tell you to do? What is your move here? What move do you make in this situation? You got anything for me on that one? Damn straight, and stop being so generous with your credit. Just lay off the nice credit lines. There's no question here. They're trying to generate sales by saying, hey, you can buy on credit from us. And what that's doing is that is actually eating into their cash, their free cash flow, because their receivables are going up. So a lot of that stuff they're saying is revenue didn't go to cash. So we can fix free cash flow right there. We can see right now it needs to be fixed, And that one is not that hard to fix. Although I guarantee you that your sales department is going to bitch to high heaven when you start tightening up their standards for the receivables. No, no more of this crap with 5-10 net 30. You bring that down to 2-5 net 20 or something like that. Well, I mean, we got a good relationship with these. Knock it off. You're already making plenty of money. They're not going to move on us just because we're wanting to tighten up, just like you said, tighten up our credit generosity a little bit. Now, inventory to sales. Hatfield is keeping a little more inventory than is normal. Is that enough for us to worry about? Remember, inventory is actually a use of cash flow, free cash flow. And we see right here that their inventory is a little higher than what is standard in the industry. Again, is 1% shaving off? Well, there are actually ways. I don't know if you've taken a course in management science, but there are ways that you manage your inventory cycle. Down to a certain level, you trigger to reorder. And then you're down to that level again, that's a trigger to reorder. In a case like this, you might be able to do it by simply lowering the trigger. Well, instead of reordering whenever we have 20 of the units in inventory, let's reorder when we have 15 in inventory. That's going to be your fastest way to tighten up your inventory, is to just shave that trigger down a little bit. Were you taught this in any business course? I'm just curious about that. Okay. Oh, really? Yeah, I mean, it's not hard, but when you think about it, this is actually kind of a critical thing, knowing where that trigger is, because you don't want a trigger so low that you can stock out. You don't want it that low. But you also don't want a trigger that's so high that it's actually eating into your cash flow, because too much inventory is actually a cost to you because you have to keep it somewhere. You have to store it. And, of course, you can get down to the point where you have almost zero inventory. What was it I saw? Amazon has an inventory turnover ratio of 12 times a year or something like that. In other words, they clear their inventory 12 times every year. And it's kind of funny that way because they bitch at me. I have an Amazon store, and they say, you should send us some of your stuff so that we've got it ready to ship for two-day shipping. Now, that's kind of hard when you're an artist to, let me paint like 20 of these and I'll give it to you and I'll ship them to you. But for them, they then, if you send them too many, they start bitching at you, as is the case with another seller I'm good friends with, a bookseller. And they say, we want this many. So he sends them that many. And then a couple of months later, they say, don't send us that many. Are you out of your mind? So they manage their inventory very tightly, and it's all computerized with SAP and other abominations like that. Okay, fixed assets to sales. There you go. There's your dinner right there. Look at that fixed assets to sales. It's just total. It's way out of whack. Their fixed assets are too high. There's more evidence of it. Stop buying new stuff. Let your depreciation eat some of that fixed asset base away, so that you don't have those numbers that are out of whack. I'm looking right now, and I'm trying to get you. That's what my purpose is here. And I'll let you go here in just a little bit. But my purpose here is for you to see where your questions should be and why it's better to use the industry than your own ratios. Because when you, at least looking at the industry's ratios, you then are focusing on the right questions. Here, we've got answers right now. Fixed assets are too high. Their terms of credit are too generous. Those are questions that we can now answer. Okay, their accounts payable to sales are really high. So in other words, you put off paying bills an awful lot compared to the industry. Is that bad or is that good? The answer is, it's neither, but I can guarantee you your suppliers are going to figure out that you don't pay nearly as fast as others do, and you're going to have problems with them over time because your competitors are going to be paying their bills faster than you are, so they're going to get service a lot. They're going to provide your competitors a lot faster than they're going to provide for you. You can be a skinflint for only so long before everyone figures out you don't pay your bills very well, very fast. And so in this case, it's not that this is a bad number. Hell, that's a great number. It's that that number is probably unsustainable. That's what I was talking about earlier. Now your tax rate. Well, damn it, there they put the 25%. Oh. Okay. Here is an interesting number. Your debt to total assets, one of those classic ratios. Your optimal capital, your capital structure is way outside of the industry. Now, here's the thing. Is the whole industry wrong to have a weighted a capital structure that's 16%, 17% debt and 83% equity, and you are the wonderful exception who sees it the right way while everyone else is wrong? Don't ever, ever think that. You see, because if all of your friends are soldiers and they're all running this way and you're still running that way, saying, boy, are they a bunch of cowards, then we're going to have a name for you. We call you KIA, if you know what that stands for. Your total liabilities to total assets, there you go. Now, there's going to be a slight discrepancy in here because they're counting only debt, not the total of your liabilities. But still, okay, your times interest earned. You can cover your debt 3.8 times over with EBIT. The industry can cover it almost about three times as fast as you can, as much as you can. So again, who's wrong? Are you wrong? Are they wrong or are you wrong? You notice that number 3.8, that's getting down there. It's not scary. 1.2 is scary. Anything below 1 means that you're already dead. But at 3.8, the industry is at 10.2. That would tell us that they're carrying way too much debt in their capital structure, which you see up there at the top. You see how there is plenty, 10 times over, the industry's participants can pay their interest with the money that's available to it. You can pay it only 3.8 times over. That means that you are carrying a lot of debt, too much debt, probably. I mean, just on a basic level, 3.8 is something that's nosebleed. Overall, you see some companies that just don't believe in debt. Their times interest earned is like infinity, something like that. Yeah, EBIT divided by zero interest. But overall, 7 is a normal number to see for times interest earned. 7 in some industries, maybe about 15, a little higher than that in other industries. But I mean, when you get down there to 3.8, you're scary. Because if your sales even fart, it's going to cascade down the line to EBIT, and EBIT is not going to be able to cover your interest. That's the danger of getting too much debt in your capital structure, which also probably means that their debt, their cost of debt, is getting pretty steep. Because lenders, yeah, we'll lend you money, but we're going to charge you a pretty high coupon rate for that money because you're getting into scary territory where a fart in sales could drive you into default. We don't like that, so we're going to charge you a high default premium. Okay, ROA. Now, call me a little bit skittish, but I'd say that when the industry ROA is twice your return on assets on the industry is twice yours, you've got a problem. So what's the problem here? One would be ROA is net income divided by total assets. One thing is that their total assets, because their fixed assets are so large, their total assets are abnormally large, so their net income over total assets is going to be lower than it should be. That's one clear indication right there. The other one is they're not generating enough net income. That tells me that there's a problem here with this. They're not generating enough net income, and they are overloaded with fixed assets compared to the industry. Okay. And ROA, an ROA, overall, you should see an ROA somewhere between about 8% and 18%. That's a normal range for ROAs for companies. And theirs is well below that. Profit margin, there it is. Their net income is pathetic. That's probably another factor that's driving ROA down. They got too many fixed assets, too little net income. So that's why their sales, their profit margin is low. Sales to total assets, there you go. They're not, they've got too many assets. For as much as they are generating in terms of sales, for as little as they're generating, their asset base is way too large. Now, if you're a retail company, let's say you're a retailer, and that number is too, that number right there, sales to total assets, is too low, what would you do as a retail company? Just off the top of your head, you got any idea? Be a bastard. I'd close some of my weak stores. I'd shut them off. I'd just close them, sell the building, or get out of the lease and walk away from it. They're not that's fixed assets. We get rid of a fixed asset, and it wasn't generating much in terms of revenues anyway. You just clean out the dead wood in your company. That's one of the things that I would do with a situation like this. It's one of the fastest ways you can reduce your fixed asset base. And at the same time, you're going to lose some of your net income, but you're not going to lose as much of a percentage. You keep your profitable stores. That's what companies do all the time. They get rid of their weaklings and move on. Sometimes you can get to the point where you're trimming and trimming, and you suddenly realize, wait a minute, we don't have any company left. Kmart is an example of that. Did you see? They have now closed so many stores that they have only 3 stores left in the world. Well, that's trimming a little too much, I would say, but, you know, that's just me. Okay, return on equity. Now, there's an interesting thing. Their return on equity, net income over shareholders' equity, is higher. And there's a reason for that. Their debt is too large. So if they move toward equity, the equity will increase in the denominator and net income over equity will fall. So that return on equity, wow, that's good. We got something good. No, it's not. That's just a consequence of things that are bad. So for example, sir, if you were to fart in an elevator, you are much happier. I mean, you did a happy elephant. But everyone else in the elevator say, oh, goddamn, we got to leave. You follow me with that? Okay, so don't be fooled by a number like that. I mean, it looks good. Wow, their return. Well, that's because they got so much debt that their equity is lower than it should be. They're off their optimal capital structure. There's no question about it. Yes, real examples for real people, by God. But, I mean, their price-to-earnings ratio is way below the industry average. And that would be because, interestingly enough, their price-to-earnings, their price is way lower than the industry's. Their earnings may be about the same, but if your price of your stock is low, you've got to ask yourself, oh, it's low for a reason. The markets aren't irrational. They're spanking that stock down because they don't like the numbers that we're looking at right now. And yes, this is done by the financial analysts at the big houses in all over the world. We look at these numbers. Some of my students, they work in what's called the back room. They're the back room people who peel these numbers apart. And even with artificial intelligence, interestingly enough, what I'm teaching you, we still aren't able to get machines, fast machine learning, to understand how to interpret this correctly. I'm talking to you in a way that computers still can't do, thinking about all the interrelationships. Okay. Return on invested capital. Well, I'm not going to go into that because I'd have to show those formulas. But anyway, You go in here and you see some of the analysis right here, what we've been talking about, and the observations. But from that, we're going to go down just very quickly. They use the DuPont. I want to get down to here and just point out this. Here's how you forecast. You put in your growth of sales from where your base is. So S1 would be $9,001 times 1 plus 11.1%. And your assets that you need, we're going to keep them right where they are now, are liabilities, the spontaneous, that's the current liabilities, are where they are. You're writing these numbers down. Now, the forecast is going to be 11% on $9,001 comes out to be exactly $10,000. Now, your growth, your sales are going to grow by 11%. So your increase, $9,001 to $10,000, your sales will grow by $999. Your profit margin, that was that number before. Your asset to sales, we saw that. Payout ratio, showed you that. And your current liabilities to sale are 18%. We are going to use those as the basis for projecting. We start with the sales at $10,000, and then we just follow these numbers down the line to see these percentages down the line to see what we get for the projections for next year. And then we just follow it through with the free cash flow analysis. And I'm going to stop there before I get you any more bleary-eyed. Like I said, it's voluntary. If you want to do that last Chapter 12 assignment, you can. It won't count against you if you won't. Otherwise, I go on to give you one last lecture on the Federal Reserve next week, and then we review the week after that for the final. That's all I have for you tonight. I thank you.